Welcome to the Berkman Center Luncheon Series podcast for Tuesday, May 6th, 2008. This week's presentation is from members of the Berkman Center's own Citizen Media Law Project. They discuss the project's accomplishments over its first year, including the creation of a state-specific legal guide for citizen media creators, the development of a database of legal threats directed at online expression, and recent litigation efforts on behalf of online publishers.
So let me start by talking a little bit about what do we mean by citizen media. And I'm not going to get into a discussion now about how do we define citizen journalism, citizen media. That could take the whole day, the rest of the day, and probably the rest of the week. Instead, we're going to talk about three sites that have relevance to us because of the work we've done, and I think also epitomize the characteristics that we are looking to focus on with the project. The first is ibrattleboro.com, the other is Neurodiversity Weblog, and WikiLeaks. So ibrattleboro.com, I would classify as the quintessential community journalism, hyper-local initiative in Brattleboro, Vermont. It was founded in 2003 by Chris Grocki and Lisa LePage. It describes itself as a locally owned citizen journalism site. It's advertising supported, as you can see on the side. And it allows its users to, quote, read and write their own news, interviews, and more, pick a local Brattleboro story, and cover it yourself or with friends. Another example is a blog called Neurodiversity Weblog, which came to our attention about a month or so ago when the woman who runs the blog received a subpoena that we offered our assistance to help her. She ended up drafting a motion to quash on her own, demonstrating an incredible legal writing ability, and the judge quashed the subpoena in New Hampshire District Court, which was a big victory for her, and I actually also ordered that the lawyer who issued the subpoena, which was out of some litigation involving drug companies in Virginia, to show cause under Rule 11 why you shouldn't be sanctioned for issuing the subpoena in the first place. She had published. So the blog tends to, as she described it, includes, quote, opinionated essays and letters. She tends to follow very carefully the litigation over vaccines and autism, which is an area that she has a great deal of expertise about and is a fairly controversial area. Because of some of the postings she made, criticisms about a lawsuit against Bayer, that's where the subpoena came out of that litigation. This is a little different than the iBrattleboro site. It doesn't have advertising on the site per se. You'll see on the right-hand side, there's a, at the bottom, Amazon referral link. So there's some ways of making money through that, but it's not primarily an advertising-driven venture. The third example is WikiLeaks, which is quite different than the other two. It was founded by an international group of activists and dissidents to develop a, quote, uncensorable Wikipedia for untraceable mass document leaking and analysis. It's primarily interested in exposing oppressive governments and corrupt corporations. Articles on the site are reviewed by an editorial team of professional journalists and anti-corruption analysts before they are covered, before they are published. And this came to our attention because WikiLeaks was the recipient of a lawsuit from a Swiss and Cayman Islands bank, which claimed that some of the documents posted up on the site came from one of their former employees and were internal bank records. So the bank sought an ex parte injunction in the Northern District of California. So ex parte means that the other side wasn't given an opportunity to respond. WikiLeaks didn't get a chance to make any arguments on its behalf, and the judge, based on the arguments of the bank, decided to issue an order which required their domain name registrar to take down the site completely. So for some period of time, if you typed in WikiLeaks.org, you got nothing but a blank page, and that was because the judge ordered that to be the case. That's a pretty extreme sanction for the publication of potentially internal documents. There's never been a prior restraint issued like that ever in the United States. In fact, in the Pentagon Papers case, the government didn't ask to take down the entire New York Times. It simply said, don't publish the Pentagon Papers. So this, rather than being even a narrowly tailored prior restraint to take down just the bank's documents, the judge issued a very broad order. This caused a great deal of interest amongst media companies, and we were able to help organize a coalition of traditional media companies and new media companies to file an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in support of WikiLeaks, arguing to the judge that He was way beyond his authority in issuing the injunction, that it was a terrible precedent, and 2 weeks after he issued it, he reversed himself, dissolved the injunction against WikiLeaks, and then a week later, the banks withdrew their lawsuit. So these three sites epitomize the target audience that we're after, and they share some common characteristics. The first is that they're operated individually or by small groups, typically not connected to a larger organization or corporate entity. And what does that really mean? That means they tend to have little or no journalism training. I would say that's starting to change now that journalists are shifting careers from old media to new media. They're joining some of these ventures and starting new ventures. But they tend to have little or no knowledge of media law. And they have few financial resources. So with those common characteristics in mind, that was the sort of birth of the Citizen Media Law Project, which started in a conversation that Phil, Dan Gilmore, and I had a little over a year, about a year and a half ago, where Dan Gilmore was lamenting that there wasn't somewhere that these new journalism initiatives could go to for legal help. And as a result, we put together a mission statement, and it really hasn't changed much since that 18 months ago, and that is to provide legal training and resources for individuals and organizations involved in citizen media, to provide advocacy on some of these issues, and to build a community of lawyers, academics, and others around these things as well. So as Phil mentioned, we started a year ago, April 2007. We launched our blog with one blogger, that was me. Please don't go back and look at those blog posts because they're really terrible. Shortly after we launched the website in May, we were very fortunate to receive a Knight Foundation News Challenge Award, which has funded us over the last year and really allowed us to do the things we've been able to do. In November of this past year, in 2007, we launched our Legal Threats Database. That has grown to... I've got the numbers, but I think we're now almost 300 published entries in the database and another almost 200 entries in the queue. In January of this past year, we launched the first two major sections of our legal guide, and I'll go through and talk about that in a little more detail later on. And then in February of 2008, we participated in our first amicus effort, which I described in the WikiLeaks case. We would like to do more of that. The nice thing about doing amicus filings is you don't actually represent the party, so your participation can be just for one brief, it can be for a series of pleadings, but you don't actually have to worry that the case is going to drag on for 10 years, and once all the students go for the summer, you're stuck having to draft things. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is, so we've got a couple other things on the site also that I want to point out. In addition to the blog, we do a weekly newsletter. And if those of you are interested in subscribing to it, it has recent media law news, it has new threats added to our database, new things and interesting things we have going on. You can sign up on our site to do that. We also have lots of links to other legal resources and a set of primers on various legal topics. So the legal guide, which we started rolling out in January of this past year, is meant to be focused on the legal needs of citizen media, those types of sites that I gave examples of. The Knight Foundation had funded us over this past year to do a legal guide that's focused on the 15 most populous U.S. states in the District of Columbia. That covers about 65% of the U.S. population. There's currently 452 section pages published on the site, and as Phil wanted me to point out, many of those pages print out to 7 or 8 printed pages, so There's quite a bit of material on there. We hope people are not going and printing out the guide. That would not be the best use of the electronic information on our site. But we've often thought there may be some uses for small parts of it to be published. And it covers 6 major topic areas. The first three sections we put up, and they're listed here in order of when we published them, covered forming a business and getting online, which covers things like how to create a business, deciding whether to be anonymous, and if you decide to be anonymous, how to do that, deciding whether and how to license your content, and then some basic links to journalism skills and principles. The second major section we put up on the site is dealing with online legal risks. This is things you can do to reduce your legal risk through complying with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, finding insurance. If you do get sued or are the recipient of a legal threat, how do you find legal help? We've got links to pro bono legal associations, organizations throughout the country. Also, help if you want to do it yourself. Where can you go to the library to find information if you want to represent yourself? And generally, what steps should you take if you're going to be responding to a legal threat? The next section we put up was news gathering and privacy, which talks about things like, can you enter the property of others? Things involving trespassing, what's called media ride-alongs, which are not so popular anymore, but they used to be quite popular, where a reporter would go along with the local fire department or police department and report on things that the cops were doing. The states haven't been too keen on that. It tends to violate trespass laws, and we tend to recommend that certainly citizen media, citizen journalists, don't engage in those activities. But, you know, we talk about which states permit it and which states don't. We talk about gathering private information. These are things like using telephoto lenses, using high-powered audio recording devices to gather news and information. What are the safe ways of recording phone calls, conversations, meetings, and hearings? The states differ on those things, and you can easily get into trouble if you're recording a phone call and the other person on the call is not in your state and you simply follow just your state's requirements. Laws around acquiring documents and other property and protecting your sources and source material, that goes into state shield laws and the reporter's privilege. The other major sections include access to government information, which we were quite excited to put up last month because this is one of the sections that talks about using the law proactively and how can the law benefit you to gather news. The previous sections we talked about tend to be how do you reduce your liability. This section covers how do you do a better job by getting access to government records using things like FOIA, using the state counterparts to FOIA, accessing government meetings, which Sam put in a tremendous number of hours trying to understand, and I can tell you that those statutes were drafted so that no one can understand them, which is why hardly anyone ever attends government meetings. Access to Congress and the President, and access to courts and court records. All these are, we think, are very fruitful areas for citizen media to really have an impact because you can collect these things largely without cost. They're available in many instances electronically, and there's a tremendous depth of information available in there. Just this past month, we published the intellectual property sections, and I want to give a special thank you to Alan Ryan, who's sitting here today. Alan and I met at a conference at BU last fall on new media, and he expressed interest in the project. He followed up with an email, and because he was foolish enough to volunteer, we asked him to do something, and he wrote a fantastic overview section to copyright. He teaches classes in these areas, and he really took the right focus, we thought, and did a fabulous job with it. Well, thank you. We also published sections on trademark and trade secrets. And then the last section to go up on the site, which is still in the works now, is risks associated with publication. These are things like defamation, false light, rights of publicity, sections on CDA 230, the Communications Decency Act, which is obviously a major issue in this area, anti-SLAPP laws, retractions, and corrections. So I'm going to give you a little idea of how the legal guide works in practice. Ooh, we don't want to see that page. That's for later. So this is our home page. If you were to click on this link up here to go to the legal guide, it would take you to a page that looks like this. We provide a number of ways for people to get into the materials. The first thing is you can search for any topic area. You can limit it by jurisdiction, so you can say, I only want to know about Alabama, Alaska, or Arizona, which if you pick those, you wouldn't get much because those are not in the 15 most populous states. We do have some stuff on some of these other states, but if you were to click on California, you'd probably have more luck. You can also limit your search just to a subject area. Alternatively, you can click on a state and go to that state's section. We'll click on California, which is one of the states we did cover. Because sometimes things can be a little slow here, I already opened that page. Here's the California legal page. And so it has a summary of all the information on the site that relates to California. So on the right-hand side, you'll see these are legal threats in our database that were filed in California or relate to California law. We have a section here on the right of also our blog posts that involve California. and a list of the specific California pages and where they fall under our section headings. So if you wanted to see about legal protections for anonymous speech in California, you could click on that and it would tell you how amenable the courts are in California to protecting anonymous speakers. There's obviously a First Amendment right to speak anonymously. In some contexts, states' courts have done differing, taken differing approaches on how to protect that right. So every state that we've covered, the 15 most populous states, by the way, all these tabs you're seeing here are because I'm signed in as an administrator. I probably should have signed out. You wouldn't normally see those, and you certainly wouldn't have the ability to edit these pages.
But maybe you should.
Yeah, maybe you should. Well, that's one of the things we want to talk about. So I'm going to step you through one of the sections, which we think is a very interesting section, and that's on forming a business. So if we go back to the main page here, if you decide you don't want to click on a state, you just want to browse the guide by section. Here are the major sections here. There's an introduction to the legal guide, and then those are the topic areas that I talked about when I gave an overview. If you were to look at forming a business and getting online, this is a section that really talks about, some of these sections talk about, do you want to create some kind of a formal business entity around your online publishing activities? That may not be the best solution for everyone, but we want you to think about it from the context of what are the pros and cons of doing it, and then we step you through that. So the first section here on creating a business, if someone were to go to that section, it talks about, first of all, choosing a business form. What are the different business forms you could choose from partnerships through to corporations? If you decide to pursue creating a business, how do you do it? That's a section on how to start a business. And then there are other business formation and governance issues that we cover in a sort of catch-all category here. So I'll step you right through this as quickly as I can. So choosing a business form, there are obviously several choices at least, from sole proprietor, informal group, partnership, LLCs, which tend to be quite the rage. And thanks to Oliver, it's now much easier to form some of these in Vermont. So if you're listening on the webcast and you want to create a journalism venture online, think about Vermont. We've got a major section on nonprofits. So for purposes of our discussion today, I'm going to assume that you want to form a nonprofit corporate organization. If you click on that section, by the way, each of these sections talks about the various pros and cons and compares them. There's also a business form comparison chart that lays them out. If you were to click on the nonprofit organization section, it will take you through a discussion of the things you need to be aware of. First of all, what is a nonprofit? Give some examples of nonprofits in the world that you might be aware of. Talks about some of the characteristics like liability. What are the concerns for liability amongst the organizers, the managers, the officers of a nonprofit? What are the issues that relate to formation? Is this too small for people to read? Okay. The various steps of how to form a nonprofit. Talks about the management structure. There are certain requirements that you have a management structure to be a nonprofit. The IRS is not keen on giving tax-exempt status if you're just going to run it out of your closet by yourself and there's no other control over it. There's also sections on operation. There are various requirements you have to have as far as meetings, so on and so forth. Ownership of assets and distribution of profits. Tax treatment, of course, that's the big daddy for being a nonprofit. There's also prohibitions on political and legislative activities, so on down the road, other considerations. So you can see this is one of the biggest pages on the site. There's a lot of fairly dense material there. We've tried to write it in such a way that a layperson would be able to
If I can
understand.
Jump in.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a lot of these the main heading categories, like liability formation, tax treatment, things of that nature, each of the different business forms, I've sort of designed the pages so, you know, you're getting a liability. There's a little discussion of liability on each of them, and so it's mostly a comparative and, you know, compare and contrast type exercise. But then, of course, there's certain characteristics or issues that are distinct or unique to particular business forms. Like here, you have this political, the issues with political and legislative activities. So that's something you only see on the nonprofit.
So if you've read through this section and decided nonprofit is the way to go, we want to help you actually put that into practice. You would click on this link, Forming a Nonprofit. I should also show you that you can access all the table of contents to the guide on the right-hand side. So if you were to say, I want to start the business, you could either do it from the internal link on the page or do it directly from the
table of contents. Here's the section on forming a nonprofit corporation. And this steps you through. This was put together in such a way that we give you a stepwise approach to doing it. It may not be the case that everyone could form a nonprofit just based on this information here in the guide. You may have a complicated situation. We try to identify those issues, flag them for you, and suggest that you hire a lawyer if you need to do that. We did get a comment back from one person saying that they never had to leave our site and were able to form a nonprofit. That may work for some people. It may not work for others. So as you all the steps are here. Plan your annual budget.
This is general information.
This is general information. And exactly. So forming a business is a creation of state law. The nonprofit status is both a function of the state taxing authority and the Internal Revenue Service. So there's overlap on that. But the first step generally requires forming an entity within the state. So you'll want to go to the state law forming a nonprofit corporation section, where we go through the 15 states that we cover in the District of Columbia. So forming a nonprofit corporation in California, this gives you the specifics of how to do it in California, links to the California Corporations Code, explanations for what you have to do, the various things you have to file.
Yeah, sample articles of incorporation, a lot of the little forms here and there, and explanations of where to go. And I'm really happy with the stuff. And Ryan was instrumental in putting a lot of this together.
So we tried to include as many links as possible to other resources, other sites that talk about this generally, and then leave resources that are available within state agencies. So this section is somewhat indicative of the other sections, and it certainly is in our approach, which is to take relatively complex and dry legal information and present it in a compelling and interesting and easy to understand way for non-lawyers, and then to provide links out to other resources. Try to be as complete as possible, but flag issues that we think people should be aware of that necessitate additional legal help. We're going to take our first look at the legal threats database. This is the first time we've discussed any of the data in it, and we're hoping that this group can give us some feedback on it. So in addition to the legal guide, we also, over the past year, have created this database of legal threats directed at online publishers. The idea was to include lawsuits, subpoenas, cease and desist letters, and other forms of legal threats. Wendy just left, but I should say the idea for creating this database came to me as a result of Wendy's work on Chilling Effects Clearinghouse, which Wendy created, I think, 5 or 6 years ago, and is the place for cease and desist letters online. And that model was the model I used to build out this, which we look to expand the types of threats we would include and focus primarily on citizen media and online journalism. The database currently contains 290 published entries from 40 U.S. states and 8 countries. Each entry includes a description of the threat, links to blog or press coverage. Most also include the underlying documents, including the lawsuit complaints, motions, court orders, and correspondence. All of that is full-text searchable on the site, as well as the entries and the materials that we've created. The database is publicly searchable by keyword in 25 distinct data fields, including by date, by legal claim, by type of publisher, was it published on a blog, was it published in a forum, and by subject area. So let's see. So if you were to go to the database page on the site, this is what you'd be greeted with, a little explanation of the site. A list on the right-hand side of recent threats that have been entered into our database by types, so recent lawsuits, recent subpoenas, recent letter or email threats. And then we allow commenting on threats, so these are recent threat comments. And then blog posts that we've entered that are tagged as relate to legal threats. There are several different ways that people can access information in the database. Searching is probably the most common way people do. You can do keyword searching here. You can limit it by threat type. I only want criminal threats. I only want subpoenas. You can limit it by the sending or suing party, by the type of publication medium. Was it on broadcast? Was it email? You can do it by court type. I only want federal court. I only want state court, so on.
We also list new threat entries here on the right. And then we've got this little thing called most viewed legal threats. And the winner has been almost from day one, the Johnson v. Tucker Max case. And if you aren't familiar with that, that's was Miss Vermont sued a fellow by the name of Tucker Max, who publishes a blog about his exploits involving women. It's a extremely salacious, we're not going to go into it today, it's not surprising that that's the most popular one. We still get, this case wrapped up years ago, and we still get dozens of hits a day to this entry. Not really sure why that is. We collect information into the database in several different ways. Obviously, a database like this is only as good and useful as the information that's in it. And we try to bring information in several different ways. One is we try to get users of the site to submit information to us. We have a threat entry form, which a user can click on and create. The only required field is that they have a title. Beyond that, they can put in information regarding, say, the date. We have little explanations for each of these. They select the threat type. Did it come via correspondence? Did it come via a lawsuit? The parties, names of the parties, the types of parties, whether they're individuals, organizations, whether they're the government, various categories, subject areas, the content type, was it audio, was it video, the court types, the names of the lawyers, so on. It's a little bit of an imposing form. We've been struggling, I'd say, over the last year of how to make this more approachable. We're definitely open to suggestions on how to do that. We've had a handful of people come in and create new threats through the threat entry form. More often what we do is we get an email from somebody saying, hey, I've been threatened. It's then up to us to go out and research it and create the threat entry. So I guess somebody on IRC asked, what is a legal threat? Is that coming through IRC? I'm going to go through and talk about the different kinds of legal threats we have on here. But a legal threat could be anything from a lawsuit, which is pretty clearly a legal threat. Someone gets sued for defamation or copyright infringement based on material they have on their blog. That's a legal threat. We're not making a statement of whether or not we think it's justified. The database is trying to be as objective as possible, simply identifying that the threat exists and then providing information about it. A threat could also be an email sent to a blogger saying, if you don't take that information down, I'm going to sue you. We also have threats in the database that were comments. Someone posted a comment. We have one in the database where a police chief in New Jersey put a comment up to a blog saying, if you guys don't drop this, I'm going to come and I'm going to search your premises and I'm going to arrest you. That's a legal threat. It's, you know, kind of a weird one, but it's a legal threat. So we define legal threats quite broadly. A legal threat can also be, we have what's called denial of access. A blogger in Illinois, who actually was a former journalist working for the local newspaper, who left the organization to start her own blog, a journalism-based blog, tried to cover a juvenile proceeding, and the judge said, hey, aren't you a blogger? Yeah, I'm a blogger. Well, you're going to have to leave. You can't stay. Only real journalists can stay. We classify that as a legal threat. So it's quite broad. So as I said, the information comes in various different ways. Most do come in via email. In fact, actually most come in because we go out and find them. So as I mentioned, the quality of the data is dependent on our collection methodology. There's three different ways that they come in. Primarily, they do come in because we go out and find them. We run a number of searches daily, Google News searches, Technorati searches, a bunch of automated Westlaw searches that look for new lawsuits and new pleadings. All entries are reviewed by our staff prior to publication. So if a user creates a threat, what you do find out with these is they're disputes, and it isn't always easy to isolate the facts of the dispute. We try to be as objective as possible. If we were just allowed people to create threats on their own, immediately have them be published, we're afraid that the site would become a shouting match, which is not what we want it to be. We want it to be a resource that that people can have some reliance on. So I'm going to go through and give you some overview of the current statistics in the database. As I said, there's 290 published threats and 177 that are in the queue, which requires staff review.
some of those may not actually make the final cut, but many of them do. Threats by type, as I talked about, we've got various different types of threats. The most common in the database at this point is lawsuits. We have 281 threats that are lawsuits, 98 that are correspondence. This would be email. I think we have any
traditional phone? Letters.
Yeah, traditional letters. Subpoena threats, disciplinary actions. These are a category that we added after we started that include things like an employee being fired for blogging. And students in schools that are disciplined for publishing online as well. There are a handful of criminal threats in here, criminal libel and other criminal threats. Denial of access, I mentioned that earlier. And then there are some that are just labeled as other, which we couldn't think of another thing to categorize them as.
281 suits filed or 281 letters saying I'm going to sue you?
No, if it's lawsuits, those were lawsuits filed. So 281 lawsuits.
And I actually have a question also.
Sure.
I thought a legal threat, I was assuming a legal threat is a threat that's done through the legal system?
No, it's a threat to use the legal system.
So what's a criminal legal threat? That seems
a criminal legal threat is someone who's been charged with a crime. Or a threat of criminal activity.
I got it. Okay. I thought it was me threatening to beat somebody up with a tire iron.
No.
That's a criminal, illegal. No.
but you do raise an interesting question because these disciplinary actions are more tenuously connected to the legal world. They're not, I'm going to take you to court and the court's going to force you to pay money. It's more, I'm going to fire you because I can, because I don't like that you blog. But the legal system, in a sense, upholds the ability to uphold your contract to fire your employees, even more tenuous, maybe in schools, to throw the kid out or suspend the kid because they're being unruly. It's not really couched in legal terminologies as such, but we include it because we think it's relevant.
So so the idea behind the way we structure the database is to include. Some of you may be sitting here saying, "Well, I wouldn't agree that that's a legal threat." That's fine. We built the database in such a way that you can only include the things that you want to include through the tagging that's available in the searching. So if you say, "I'm only interested in lawsuits," it's all you have to be worried about. You're only going to get lawsuits, and that goes in other categories as well. The idea being to try to cast the net as wide as possible. Bring in as much information and then allow users of the site and researchers to slice it up and manipulate the data in ways that works best for them.
Yeah, you can think of it as a funnel.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of having like a narrow entryway in and then just a broad sort of layout or structure, it's sort of you get into the database with the big end of the funnel and then you can choose to control what you see so that it becomes narrow.
So this is a breakdown of the threat. So maybe back up. So this is published and unpublished threats. So if you were to add up all these numbers, it would be more than the 290 that I said are currently published on the site. All the rest of the slides for the day in the database are published threats. So these have all been reviewed, confirmed, and published on the site. This is a breakdown of the jurisdiction of the threats within the database. 21%, the largest number, come from California. Which probably isn't surprising. California is the most populous state, but it's not 21% of the population. I think California is roughly 12% of the population. So there may be other factors going on here. We haven't looked deeply into the data, but this is the kinds of questions we want to be asking and why we think the database can be useful in looking at these things. Perhaps it's due to broadband penetration. Perhaps it's due to more people engaging in speech in California than in other states. But it's more than just proportional to California's population.
Can you mention copyright?
Yes.
Take copyright off.
Good. I don't know. This includes all of the legal claims. We could do that. We could run that search and see who it is. But I don't know off the top of my head.
So you can see roughly it does track population size. New York, Texas, Florida are the largest. Then it breaks out that way. This is legal claims. The biggest category of legal claims, and keep in mind that lawsuits can have more than one legal claim. In fact, many of them do. One of the things we're seeing that's come somewhat interesting is you do sometimes see defamation and copyright claims made in the same lawsuit. and defamation has roughly 30%. There are a bunch of other interesting claims we start to see, things like negligent infliction of emotional distress, criminal libel, luckily, is only 1%. But we tend to see in many of these a kitchen sink approach by some plaintiffs' lawyers, especially when it relates to business disparagement and business libel. They add in a lot of breach of contract, business disparagement, tortious interference.
Tortious interference. It's not like only the fourth one in line there. Doesn't really have much of its own essence. I mean, that's sort of a kitchen sink thing. You see that thrown in with defamation claims, and that's really, you're never going to see one of those claims by itself. But it comes up a lot, apparently.
So other legal claims we've identified, which are grouped in here under other, are intrusion. That's a news gathering tort involving a privacy violation, not the publication, but the actual gathering of information. Trespass, wiretapping, access to courts, access to government records. These are those would be FOIA lawsuits that were filed to vindicate FOIA rights, for example. Conversion is the legal fancy term for theft, involved document leaking, election law violation. I think we've got one of those in there. Is that the daily costs thing?
I'm not sure.
There was a complaint filed against Marcos Melitzis, who runs the daily costs, that he was engaging in political activities because he had taken a strong stand endorsing parties and candidates, and that therefore he was required under federal election code to disclose all of his sources of income and so on and so forth. The FEC said that we're not going to hold him to that standard. We do not think he qualifies and falls into that category. But that would be a legal threat we'd be interested in.
Should we explain how this other category is sort of a, it's just been put together because of the, they were only 1% or less?
Yeah. It's a combination of other. We haven't obviously identified every potential legal claim that someone can have. Some are so infrequent that it wasn't worth creating a tag for them. Those are in the other category. And then all of these other includes, these were all ones that were less than 1% in the database, and they all add up and added into the other as well. So this is threats by disposition. 93 of the threats in the database are currently pending. Of the cases that are no longer pending, the more than any other categories have settled. 40 of those have settled. That's not surprising. Those of you who've handled litigation know that most cases do tend to settle. A large number have been dismissed, and that's a total dismissal. That means the case was over. 35 have been withdrawn. Some overlap between settled and withdrawn. It would not be tagged twice, but a withdrawn if there wasn't an offer of settlement or any exchange. If the party just voluntarily dismissed, that would be labeled as withdrawn. Dismissed partial. You could have a case that was partially dismissed and then ultimately totally dismissed, so it could appear in both of those columns. Lawsuit filed. This is an interesting one we created when we were looking at a lot of these letters, the threatening letters that come in. It's an interesting question. How many of those letters actually result in lawsuits? We're trying to figure that out. So we created a tag for lawsuits filed so you can actually run a search for a correspondence type of threat. So you'd get all of the hits in our database that are correspondence threats and see how many of those ultimately resulted in a lawsuit. With two categories on here are labeled with red. One is injunction issued. That includes injunctions that were perhaps later denied or withdrawn, because our feeling is that an injunction, even if it applies for only a short period of time, creates some injury. So we want to flag that. That's why it's labeled in red. Subpoena quashed. That's instances where the party was able to get the subpoena dismissed by a judge. Verdict for plaintiff, that's a very small number, as you would probably expect. These tend to be hard cases to win, especially in the defamation context. Injunction denied, 12, and then verdict for defendant. So the ones that are labeled verdict means that they actually went to a verdict. It went fully through the process, either a bench or a jury trial. And those are rather small numbers. Threats by year. This is a breakdown of a handful of the categories. Sure.
If you were to look at those dispositions again, is that, I know you said, is that typical Is it typical that that few go to verdict?
Yes. Yeah.
So this is a normal sort of.
These numbers comport with my experience doing media litigation, and I think litigation generally, few cases go to trial. I think in the media law context, even fewer tend to go to trial.
My one thought is that you might have more dismissed and withdrawn here than you would in a normal litigation context. I think people will jump to litigation in this context a little quicker than they would in others.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, one of the things, this is the very first time we've really looked at the data in aggregate. We're having this conversation today. Some of the questions you're going to ask, we don't have answers for because we haven't looked at the data in that way. And so what we want to do is we want to collect your questions because they're good insights for us. But one of the things to think about in this context, especially in the defamation context, is these are very emotion-driven litigation. They tend not to track a lot of other forms of litigation that is monetary-based, that tend to be more rational in the plaintiff's and defendant's decision-making. It'd be interesting to see whether that's supported in this new media context, especially where a lot of the disputes we see in these entries involve sort of personal animosity between the parties that bubble over into an actual legal threat.
How comfortable you are with your data set? Like, do you feel like you've gotten a complete picture of...
No. Well, we don't. And so we're going to talk about that in the end, but obviously... We're only catching a sample of what's out there. We have no belief that we're getting everything. Our hope is that our methodology is getting a sufficiently broad sample, and we're interested, we've had some conversations with some of the people who have statistics backgrounds here at the Berkman Center, and we would like to, over the next year or so, expand the database and involve some actual social science researchers to come with a rigorous statistical methodology to help us improve the data in the database to help answer that question. We do think, and I'm going to highlight a couple of interesting threats in the database, that even if the aggregate statistics aren't statistically reliable from the standpoint of the collection methodology, there's a great value to the database even apart from that. So let me quickly go through these so that we don't go for too much longer. So this is a breakdown of threats per year. You can see, 2008, we're only partway through, so those numbers have dropped down. We've seen a steady increase from 2002 through 2007. To get to Sally's question, there's a big issue when you're looking at online legal threats of the ability to find them. As you go back in time, it becomes very hard to find these, and we're going out and scouring blogs, we're going out and scouring legal pleadings. It may very well be that we simply haven't been able to capture threats earlier than that, in that those numbers are therefore reduced because of it. But my inclination is that there has been an increase over at least the last few years that corresponds maybe not to the exact slope of this curve, but roughly approximates what we're seeing here. And we've seen an increase in all of these. I think we've seen an increase in all of these categories.
Well, and certainly one question we'd be interested in input on is sort of, is there merit on some level to sort of cut off at some point and just say, you know what, why are we even going to think about worrying about 1998 and before? Because in reality, you're never going to be able to find good information going back that far.
Yeah.
So that's one thing to think about.
What do you know about the growth of citizen media?
Well, we got people here at Berkman who probably answer that better than we can.
That would be the background.
Yeah, we think there's obviously been a big growth. And that's so, you know, whether it's a question of greater litigiousness or whether it's just simply now the population has grown and that would support the growth, I think that's an important question to ask. So we've already started discussing this, but we kind of came up with some questions to prompt further discussion. We don't have to follow these in any order. We don't even have to follow this at all. How can we best analyze the data? Are there questions that you have, and hopefully Tuna's keeping track of all of the questions as they've come up, that you would like to see answered, and maybe the database can help do that? What observations and trends should we focus on? We're going to be issuing a preliminary report in the next month or two that looks at the aggregate data and puts all that together, and what are the best ways to make this data available to researchers. And actually, I skipped something.
our example.
Yeah, let's do that. So we'll go back to these questions in 2 seconds, so keep these in mind. So there are two threats that I want to we're going to show you as examples. It gives you a feel for the database, and then it'll also help. We'll go back to those questions. This is the lawsuit that was filed against iBrattleboro back in February of this year. This is what our threat entries look like. There's the title for the threat, who created it, the threat type, and its date, and then the subject areas that we've tagged it with. We identify the parties, who was the party issuing the threat, what was the party receiving the threat, what was their type of party. We're interested in knowing, one of the things we would like the data to tell us is if you are running a blog as an individual versus if you are running it with the name of a big organization, are you more or less likely to be threatened with legal action? Is there some perception that you're going to roll over because it's just you versus if you're attached to a larger organization? The location of the parties, the current status and disposition, verdict or settlement amount, if any, and then a description of the threat, any updates on the threat entry. And I'm going to go through this one in a little bit more detail, but I want to give you a quick overview of it. The court information, what kind of court it was, where it is, the case number so that you can find it, who the legal counsel are for both sides. We get a lot of lawyers who come and visit this site, so it's useful for them to see that, and I think they like to see their names as well. The publication medium, this was a user comment. It was in the form of text. The legal claims in the complaint were defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress. The source of law was Vermont. The website involved was iBrattleboro. Here are links to the full text documents, to the complaint, the answer, a motion for judgment on the pleadings, and then the order on the pleadings, and then related links. So this would be press and blog coverage on the topic. So let me give you a little bit about background on this threat. So the back in February, a user of this site, iBrattleboro.com, posted a comment in which he was the user of the site was the former executive director of a local emergency medical services company. And he posted a comment in which he mentioned that one of the volunteers in the organization had engaged in an affair with one of the organization's members of the board of trustees. She filed a lawsuit against the operators of the website and against the user who posted the comment. As with many of these kinds of suit, the comment itself was made as part of a larger issue that was being discussed on the site involving the management of this emergency services company, which had become of considerable interest to the community. iBrattleboro opens up its site for user comments. They moderate the comments for civility and appropriate language, but they, you know, otherwise allow the community to come in and create content, report on news, and comment on it. Shortly after the lawsuit was filed, we received an email from Chris Grotke, who is one of the founders of iBrattleboro, notifying us about the lawsuit. We created this legal threat entry, blogged about it, uploaded the pleadings, and started following the case. As a result of our coverage of it, we got a great deal of press interest in Vermont. Oliver did a little bit of press calls on it as well. My understanding is this was the first such case to come up in Vermont, and there was arguments on both sides of why this case should proceed or be dismissed. Under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, website operator like iBrattleboro is not liable for the comments of its users, that is a pretty straightforward application of the law, but there was great consternation in Vermont about the unfairness to that, and that because they're a journalism site, they should be perhaps held to a slightly different standard. We provided a great deal of moral support, which I didn't even realize now with these threat entries that, in fact, that it does provide moral support, because what happens is that now all of a sudden what is a little dispute most people haven't heard of, this one was well known in Vermont, but other disputes, they're eager to get the word out, the fact that they have been sued, the fact that they're facing some kind of a legal threat. And so that can provide great moral support. We also were very forceful in arguing that the Communications Decency Act should dismiss this case, And if the case had gone on, we had planned to become involved in it as a friend of the court in an amicus capacity. In March of this past year, the court dismissed it on CDA 230 grounds and dismissed the case against the two founders of the website. The lawsuit's still proceeding against the user who posted the site. And, you know, we can have a discussion later on about what are the policy reasons behind CDA 230, whether they're good or bad. Our feeling generally is that these kinds of sites, these community journalism sites, could not survive without the protection that CDA 230 provides. This is a site that it's a small set of staff. They rely on their community to provide information on the site. And because of that, the site is comprehensive in a way it could never be if it were simply the product of one or two or three people covering all of the news in Brattleboro, Vermont.
I don't want to anticipate the discussion, but what would be the distinction between that sort of setup and a small weekly newspaper that is published by three people in the same town, which has never been immunized from defamation?
Well, the simple answer to that is because Congress says it's different. So when the genesis of the Communications Decency Act was in the late 90s, it involved two cases, one involving Prodigy and the other involving CompuServe. Two libel lawsuits were filed against the two operators. CompuServe didn't do any, one of them didn't do any moderation, and which one is which one now escapes me. And the other tried to create a family-friendly, Prodigy, I think, was trying to create a family-friendly environment. So they were going through and moderating and cleaning up content. And the court said, because you've gone in and made some moderations to all of this, we're going to hold you liable as a publisher. And so the incentive there was, don't allow any user comments. If you do allow user comments, you can't touch them, you can't moderate them, you can't take anything down at all. And Congress said, we don't want to create that kind of incentive. We want to give this medium the opportunity to grow. We understand that this is a new opportunity for users who previously didn't have a vehicle to publish, to get the word out to the world. Now they can do it on the internet. But in many ways, they're beholden to these site operators in order to do that. We're going to give the site operators immunity so that they will allow this form of participation. This was in late 96. And as a result of that, there's a distinction in the offline and online world for publisher liability. In the offline world, you're exactly right. A publisher of a small newspaper, if they published a letter to the editor, they step into the shoes of the author of the letter and could be liable for anything that's stated. That's not the case in the online context, where CDA 230 draws a bright line between what's created by third parties, by users, and what's created by the staff of the website operator. I mean, that was the policy reason behind doing it, and it's strikes some people as terribly unfair. Some people think it should be applied to the print world as well. Some people think it shouldn't be applied to the online world in order to bring the two back together. So, Sam, you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, we can, but I noticed that it's 1:30. If we want to move to comments,
okay.
Any questions?
Sure.
Up to you. I'll give you another example.
Okay, well, you want to skip it?
Yeah, I think we should move on to.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. So this is a general overview. This is fairly indicative of the threats that are in our database. We try to be as objective as possible, and we try to include as much information as possible. And so now we get back to the questions of how can we best analyze the data, what observations and trends should we focus on, what's the best way to make this available to the researchers. We also have some other questions of what legal needs remain unmet. How can this organization and others meet those needs? How can we do a better job of alerting others about the resources we currently provide? And how can we bring more people into the content creation process through identifying areas in the legal guide that need more coverage? We know there are media law experts all over the country who might be eager to help. Is a wiki the right way to do that? There are not a lot of successful legal wikis in the world. That's one option. There are lots of different things to talk about, so I'll throw the floor open at this point, and you can ask these questions or others. And now, if you have a follow-up question.
I don't know if you can answer it, but it would be interesting considering how the case law is growing so exponentially. It's so difficult to prosecute, and therefore, most of it you know, fails in success, why is the number of cases growing so rapidly?
Partly, I think, because what you see with some of these lawsuits is an effort to make someone stop doing something. The threat alone often, well, I shouldn't say often, is sometimes enough. Tuna was asking yesterday if we could figure out how many threats result in material being taken down. It's hard to answer that question because the material was taken down. And the threat was never published. And so we've lost something because of that. I think of this example of the woman in New Hampshire who runs the neurodiversity blog. If you read her legal pleadings, you'd be astonished that a non-lawyer could produce something of that high quality. They clearly thought they were just going to intimidate her with a subpoena that asked for her bank account records, asked for her tax records, asked for all of her religious affiliations, you know, things that on its face appear to have no relevance at all to the lawsuit. A lawyer sent that. I'm not sure what his motivation was, but one of the motivations could be he was looking to scare her and make her stop publishing. So I think likelihood of success isn't always an indicator of the number of lawsuits that are filed, the number of legal threats that are issued. Often they come because a legal threat is a powerful thing, and it involves an expense, an emotional turmoil for the individual who receives it, and therefore it tends to be effective.
You made a joke earlier about opening some pages to edit him. Perhaps that page that you lose, the people who took it down from the threat could be open to that.
Yeah, that's good.
I think there's probably also just a growing trend in the number of suits filed and the number of threats that are taking place simply because these tools are being used. More people are blogging, more people are leaving comments, and it's simply just a snowballing effect that as the years are going on, that people are widespread.
Matt, do you have a question?
Yeah, well, actually, I was just going to go on with that. I think one of the reasons why you continue to see so many lawsuits is that since the protection is based on the CDA, which is really just like a tiny little piece of language that's been interpreted by the courts, there's so many different permutations and so many different ways that someone can say something or can go after someone for saying something that no one's really sure in an individual case, is this covered by the CDA, et cetera. And so, as you say, the chilling effect or the I'm going to use this threat as a way to get people to take material down still exists because no one's sure what the codification of the CDA is, what the exact rule is. And until that point, you know, if the CDA was something where we knew people were not liable for reproducing or saying certain things, and that was a firm standard that we had set, people would never have to respond to these threats because they could be like, I know my legal rights, you can't tell me that. But since we're not at that point yet, there are people who are thinking, well, my suit's going to be the one that can sneak past this thing because I'm in the right.
So if somebody were to take it down after the threat, would that be considered editing?
If someone were to take down
if
the material?
If somebody is threatened, and they agree to the threat and take it down,
right.
Would that be considered editing?
Would that be considered editing?
In the sense like publishing, close to publishing a newspaper?
No. No. So the decision to publish or remove content is one of the activities that's protected under it. Go ahead.
Okay. My question had to do with the research kind of question you raised in the last slide there. Just because, I mean, from what I know of, I'm a sociology grad mm-hmm. student, so from what I know of sociologists that would want to study this, the immediate question would be you'd want to know stuff about representation, whether this is actually representative of anything, what kind of population you're looking at. I mean, it's just questions that are really hard given the nature of the beast, but in terms of how to make the data available, you might also just think about issues of how easy is it to download the kinds of information that you guys were pulling off for the graphs, or just sort of accessibility questions, because
sure.
I think possibly the best thing you can do would just be to make tools and information
yep.
that you have available to researchers and let them figure out what the heck they want to do with it. That was the first part of the thing I wanted to raise. But then the second part is, in terms of opening up content creation, I wonder if you've thought about experimenting with sort of deputizing section editors beyond the people who are co-located with you here. Obviously, the amount of work that you've all put in is incredible.
Certainly, at some point, it seems like that sort of deputization has to take place, or else we can't go forward.
We can't
maintain it.
Yeah.
So that's certainly.
But it seems like also, I mean, maybe even just, I mean, there are people here who are better qualified to answer this than I am, but using some kind of, you know, peer reputation-based, mm-hmm. recommendation-based mm-hmm. evaluation system. I mean, there are all kinds of options you could use to implement those kinds of things. So if you start with deputies and then have the deputies doing this multiple evaluation process, sort of peer review, I don't know.
That's a great idea.
Oliver.
three things. One, on the data issues and the reporting, there is an empirical legal studies crowd that has a whole journal and that are getting going on these things, and they've done a lot of empirical legal work on court proceedings and that kind of thing. I'm not very up on it, but my guess is that they're looking at the same kind of sampling issues and that kind of thing you are, and so that they would be a place to go. They've got an annual meeting, I think, at Cornell, and I wanted to say September or October or something like that.
And is that what they go by? Empirical legal
studies. Yeah, there's an SSRN journal that they do. It's edited by a professor down at Yale.
Thanks. That's good.
Secondly. Bumped out of my thinking, my other points. On your question about whether to wikiize it or not, I wouldn't. And I mean, I don't mean to disparage wikis, because they can be wonderful, but there's an authority that is necessary and an accuracy that's necessary in this, which I think is better in a centralized expertise system than it would be in a distributed system. Yeah, it would correct itself, but what do you do with the four people who read the wrong material and, you know, in between? So. I think that the centralized expertise model may be a bit better would be my take. So you can't get rid of the work.
Well, keep it a franchise. Yeah. Find somebody in California and say, "All right, you write California."
Yeah.
And we'll maintain the structure. But
yeah.
And as long as they get credit.
And there may be partners to do that. I mean, for instance, the ACLU folks may have. Would be a natural to go to for some of this. There may be places you could.
Well, we're also looking for law firms. Some law firms have already approached us to talk about pro bono work. Now, the issue with them is they don't like to do the states because that's boring. They're super fancy and they get to do the exciting work, and they want to do the thinking or the structuring of the original, you know, the Massachusetts, news gathering issues.
Again, there may be some news gathering organizations that would partner with you on that. The Massachusetts League of Journalists or whatever would be a
national. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Law firms might do particular cases.
Yeah, no, there are definitely things that they are interested in. You have to just have to give them the choice.
And that's one of the long-term aims of the project, is to develop a network of pro bono attorneys interested in handling these cases. So when they come in and Arizona and places like that, we have someone we can turn to.
So I was really particularly fascinated by the policy considerations for choosing a hosting provider work that you had touched upon. What are your plans for future directions of this work, and do you plan to do it from a top-down perspective where you seek out the hosting providers and interview them about policies, or a bottom-up perspective where you solicit responses from users and see what their concerns are and experiences are?
Jeff, this sounds like a good project to get you help with.
Yeah, but this is a good point.
It is.
This sort of the issue you raise about sort of the authority and central with legal issues, this raises sort of
difference
on the border, and this might be an issue that could be dealt with in this sort of bottom-up.
Yeah. You know, so that's an excellent question. Not every company that provides server space is as willing to withstand a threatening letter from a lawyer as others are. Some are very quick and in their terms and conditions give themselves the right to take down your site for any reason, pretty much. I just had a news bit cross my desk the other day of the Pirate Bay is now offering server space, primarily geared towards those who want to publish controversial material. And they said, as long as it doesn't violate Swedish law, is that where they are?
Yeah.
Then you're safe. And since Swedish law seems to have fairly good provisions for, certainly for copyright, that may be a place to do it. Especially when you're talking about controversial speech, it's it's often difficult in these situations when someone sends a threatening letter saying, you have defamed me, and it's a political issue or a controversial issue. It's almost impossible for the server, for the organization that runs the server space, to make a determination of whether or not it is truly defamatory. So they tend to err on the side of, okay, we looked at it, it sounds bad, we're going to take it down. That doesn't have to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, given CDA 230.
Given CDA 230, yes.
That shouldn't be the case.
Yeah. And so we are seeing some organizations out there that are looking to differentiate themselves from others by providing more robust protection for controversial speech. We've got a couple of them, I think, mentioned on the site, but I imagine there's more of them out there, and going out and really doing an effort to canvas the world and collect those, I think, would be a really valuable thing for the project to do, Jeff.
And we should talk.
Yeah.
How much of the stuff that you've recorded do you think is unique to the online world, and how much of it would be likely to occur offline as well? Do you have any sense of that at all?
You mean like the topics covered in the legal guide, or the threats?
The threats.
Well, there's a threshold, sort of. I mean, on the most basic level, there's a threshold to get into the database. It has to be an online, active online speech.
Same interaction. Would you expect to see that in an offline context? Would it be something that would occur in a small town newspaper, or are they all kind of uniquely online things? You're having a level of speech you would never see otherwise, or a level of threat that you would see otherwise if it weren't online?
I think that the online space is probably unique in answering in the way these threats are playing out, for a couple of reasons. Well, one is it's obviously much easier for someone to publish than it ever was in the offline world. They can reach a far wider audience. Stuff that just ran in a small local newspaper didn't typically extend too far. An archive copy may have been kept in a local library, but that was it. You know, now everyone in the world can reach it in through Google search. It can come up 10 years later. So people are, I think, perhaps more vigilant than they were in the past. Things they might have written off, they haven't. You know, there's also, some would say, a lack of civility. So people are saying more things that they wouldn't perhaps have said in other contexts, and saying it in ways that that they wouldn't have in the past. So that may add to it. Much of this area, we're seeing a lot of threats in the database, as I mentioned, that involve a relationship that's already established between the parties that didn't go well. And that tended to create a strong emotional feeling that then resulted in a legal threat. I'm not sure if those relate, and these are relationships that didn't result because of physical proximity. They're relationships that resulted around communities. Maybe they were both commenters in a, you know, Harley Davidson forum or something like that. And those relationships might not have developed except online. So I think you're asking the right question, Robin. It'd be very interesting. It's beyond the purview of this project, but I think those are.
Yeah, I think there's also sort of like because it's so cheap and easy to publish, there's a certain sort of flippancy in the way people engage in speech. I mean, goes along with your point about sort of there's already some relationship, there's some bad blood, there's something. There are a lot of reasons why people seem to be sort of hurling rather insulting sort of speech at each other. And to be frank, I mean, a lot of what we see it doesn't necessarily have this sort of high journalism character, which is what the original idea of the project is, and we're still trying to pursue. But a lot of, if you're dealing with the hard facts of the actual cases, a lot of it is people flaming each other. And that may be particularly online activity.
Lisa, do you have a question?
I just wanted to mention Jim Greiner is an assistant professor here who's a statistician, and he's on the clinical committee. And I said to Phil, he's really interested in working with clinical programs and developing projects, and he will also use students from his class to help too, so it could be a...
Oh, great. That would be great.
So on that topic, in terms of what you can analyze, because you don't actually have a question that you're interested in. This is just sort of, we have data, want something to do.
Yeah.
What's our question?
No, I mean, our ultimate question is to help to have the data inform us where are the threats greatest, how can we address those either on our legal guide or through other legal means. But, you know, but basically we're at the stage now where we're hoping the data can start to tell us what questions to ask.
I was going in a different direction, because the problem is, you know, the non-randomness of your sample and all that.
Right.
But you could use you could just sort of turn the
explanatory variables around and use, like you mentioned, that one of these particular ones that had a whole bunch of hits associated with it. So you could potentially characterize the kinds of attributes of these different threats that you've looked at and then count the amount of interest that they're getting. So you're not studying what's getting posted, but you're studying what's getting what gets interested and what kind of gets responded to. And then each one of these things is like a little separate experiment. And then if you've been counting IP hits on your sites and stuff like that, and you may know things about the IP, like the zip code and so forth, you may be able to do much better, you know, quantitative analysis using that.
That's great.
You're going to find out why everybody wants to read about the sexual exploits.
Well, I admit, that one seemed kind of obvious, but maybe...
But there are other ones, definitely.
How much differentiation do you do among, say, the complainers?
Are they individuals, private individuals, are they companies that are suing? Is it somebody like Daily Post, who's big, you know, at Word and IBrattleboro, which I assume is a lot smaller than Daily Post? So we do, and we do tag the recipient, the sender or the initiator of the lawsuit and the recipient or the defendant with tags indicating whether they're individuals, organizations, small organization or large organizations. We're doing some of that, but I'm sure.
What is Daily Post? How do you think?
I think that would just be an organization. We're reserving large organization for like Microsoft or, you know, something that's truly gigantic.
In terms of, as a electronic publisher, he's pretty big.
Yeah, so for Daily Costs, we would approach it by, if there was a lawsuit filed, there's usually a section in every lawsuit that identifies the parties, and it would identify what the form of the organization, whether it was an organization or not. We would use that as a starting point. If that information was available, we'd do a who is search, look and see who owns the domain, whether it's an organization or an individual. If it came back with just his name, not with a Marcos LLC or something else, we would tag it as an individual, but I wrote down, I think it's not a bad thing for us to look at the category of individuals differently as well, that there are some individuals that are strictly just someone blogging out of their bedroom versus someone who's...
Who might be easily scared.
Yeah.
If you're going to attack Daily Post, very you different. Think twice about it, because if he posts it, then everybody knows about it.
And you know, in some ways... It's
whenever you create these kind of categories, they're somewhat arbitrary. Things fall into one, not the other, and you can always second guess that. But one of the things we've tried to do is create a tagging scheme that anticipates that kind of question. And I think that's one that's important. Is it, if you become well known, are you more likely or less likely to be the recipient of legal threats? Maybe you're more likely because more people are following you and they're seeing what you're doing. Perhaps you're less likely because you're now perceived as a big player in the area, and someone's not going to mess with you. But I think that's an important question we want to ask, especially as this area matures and sites like the Daily Cost become the big players and all the things that come from that.
And you distinguish between threats that are conveyed by a lawyer and just individual?
Yes, we do. We collect whether they're represented by a lawyer or not. Yeah.
I hate to cut things off. There's a lot more we could do, but we're more than that.
Thank you all very much.